This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the museum. The Obamas bookend the Clintons in Denver. Ted Kennedy wows them one more time. A primary squeaker in Alaska, and we await McCain's veep. It's all ecstasy for the political junkie.
There you go again.
You do that,
when I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it.
But I'm the decider.
On Wednesdays, NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us to discuss the presidential campaign in particular and politics in general. There's news this week from Anchorage, Lansing, and Orlando, and all of John McCain's houses. But Denver is the center of the political universe this week. Our main focus this hour is on the message you're hearing from the Democratic National Convention. A bit later, Christopher Hitchens joins us as we continue our conversation about this American moment. But first, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us from Denver. And as usual, we begin with a trivia question. Hey, Ken.
How are you, Neil?
I'm good.
Okay,
nice.
You know, President Bush, of course, is going to come to the Republican convention next week in St. Paul. Who was the last president who failed to show up at his party's convention?
So if you think you know the last incumbent president who skipped his party's political convention, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and we'll also take answers from here in the audience at the museum. Ken, last night, John Warner's keynote address,
Mark Warner,
he's replacing John. Well, he hopes to replace John Warner. But anyway, the keynote address will be little noted nor long remembered. I think we can agree on that. But Hillary Clinton delivered an address that bolstered Barack Obama and blistered John McCain.
With an agenda like that, it makes perfect sense that George Bush and John McCain will be together next week in the Twin Cities, because these days they're awfully hard to tell apart.
A 23-minute speech last night, Ken. I believe it qualifies as a stem winder.
It was a great speech. She did everything that was expected of her and more. The talk for the last couple of days was, what kind of body language would we have? We always talk about Ted Kennedy on stage at the 1980 convention in New York City, really not praising President Carter at all, who he lost to for the nomination, mostly about Ted Kennedy's agenda. And so a lot of people were wondering what she would say. But she said everything they hoped to say. Not only did it help Barack Obama, it certainly helped Hillary Clinton, too. And if nothing else, it had to have helped unify the party, because that's what so many Democrats are nervous about.
And unify the party, there was some nervousness, as you suspected, that not only might she have a lukewarm endorsement of Barack Obama, but also talk more about herself. And there's been great concern about this campaign ad that's been run by John McCain. And, of course, political polls show that something like 20% of Clinton voters might agree to support John McCain. And John McCain's been running this series of ads.
I know Senator McCain has a lifetime of experience that he will bring to the White House, and Senator Obama has a speech he gave in 2002.
Hillary's right. John McCain for president.
And that, I think she said, I'm Hillary Clinton and I don't endorse that message.
I don't approve that message, exactly. And if there's any doubt about where she stands, it was a race last night on the stage. It was forceful. It was funny. It was the best speech I think she's ever given, or at least I've ever heard her give in all her years in political life. And it was, again, a lot of Democrats before were saying, well, I still can't come over to Obama. The rules were rigged. We were cheated out of the nomination. A lot of hard feelings. It seemed like everybody on the Clinton side was upset except for Hillary Clinton herself.
Well, let's see if we get some answers to the trivia question. Joining us now on the line is Sue. Sue's calling us from National? Where's that? National?
No, Nashville.
Nashville. My screener could not quite understand. Nashville, Tennessee. Go ahead, please.
I think I actually remember President Dwight D. Eisenhower not showing up when Nixon was nominated.
And that would have been in 1960, Ken?
Yep.
Well, you know something? The answer is certainly more recent than that, but I don't remember Eisenhower standing up there for Nixon in 1960 either. There was a great Eisenhower quote in 1960 when they asked him what Richard Nixon had done to deserve a full term, and he said, if you give me a few minutes, I'll try to think of something. But I don't know if Eisenhower showed up in 60, but the answer is more recent than that.
Okay, thanks.
He probably had a good tea time, so.
Yeah.
And that was when Ike was seeing Tina Turner. It was a really unusual time for the.
Let's go to Mark.
Am I as funny away from the audience as I am at the audience?
More uproarious than ever, Ken.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of.
Mark,
yeah.
Mark is on the line from Wilmington in North Carolina.
Yes, sir. I was going to go with Truman, but that's obviously not correct.
Did you
make a guess?
You guessed
Truman and Dewey in 48.
Truman. Well, it would have been, if anything, it would have been Truman in 52, but again, it's more recent than that. Of course, Truman decided after the New Hampshire primary in 1952 not to run for a full term, and the nomination went to Adlai Stevenson, who was then the governor of Illinois. That was the last person from Illinois to be nominated until this week in Denver, but more recent than 1952.
And, Mark, okay. We're going to have to restrict you to one guess. I mean, these are strict rules we have here on Political Junkie. Let's see if we can go now to... I think Andrew is next. Andrew calling us from Easton in Pennsylvania.
Hi, Lyndon Johnson, 1968.
That is correct.
Hey!
That is correct.
We have
Lyndon
a winner.
Lyndon Johnson, like Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson didn't run for a full term in 68 because of the Vietnam War. The Chicago Convention, as everybody remembers, was a disaster for the Democratic Party. It nominated Hubert Humphrey, but Lyndon Johnson did not show up in 68 in Chicago.
Hubert Humphrey seen not wanting Lyndon Johnson to be there, not wanting to be tied to an incredibly unpopular president in an incredibly unpopular war.
And yet he almost won the election. A lot of people say if the election had gone on two more weeks or two more days or whatever, Humphrey could have beaten Richard Nixon. A very, very close election.
Let's see if we can get... thanks very much, Andrew. You win the no prize this week.
You're welcome.
And let's see. We mentioned earlier Ted Kennedy speaking to the convention just the other night in Denver. This an incredibly courageous moment. We're reading today that not only did he have the risk of he's been taking a lot of treatments for his cancer, so he had the risk of infection, but also had kidney stones the night before. It must have been incredible pain. Anyway, Ted Kennedy got up and in a surprise appearance did address the Democratic National Convention in Denver.
And this November, the torch will be passed again to a new generation of Americans. So with Barack Obama, and for you, and for me, our country will be committed to his cause. The work begins anew. The hope rises again. And the dream lives on.
And Ken, those last remarks in particular, I think, raised goosebumps on a lot of people in the crowd.
It did, and it just raised goosebumps with me. Well, and I just heard it two nights ago, but it was very similar to that stirring speech that Ted Kennedy gave in 1980 in New York at Madison Square Garden.
And let's listen to the end of that speech to the convention in 1980.
For all those whose cares have been our concern, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
And, go ahead, Ken.
I was going to say, what's fascinating about this is that the emotional pull of a Kennedy at a Democratic convention, I mean, it goes back to 1964 when they had that tribute to Bobby Kennedy, to John Kennedy, who had been assassinated 9 months before that, and Bobby Kennedy stood up on the stage in 1964 at Atlantic City at the convention. Lyndon Johnson didn't even want him there, but he knew he had to speak. And there was, again, another time when a Kennedy spoke, and we were all, everybody was brought to tears. And it came full circle Monday night in Denver with Ted Kennedy's speech.
And it had to be very... welcome for the Obama crowd to think of, before there were Clinton and Obama Democrats, there were Kennedy Democrats and Roosevelt Democrats, too. It spoke to an earlier time in the Democratic Party.
Exactly. And when we saw, when we saw Michelle Obama and we saw the Obama children on the stage Monday, it obviously, we talk about when John Kennedy said in his inaugural speech in 1961 that a torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans, it almost seemed fitting that Ted Kennedy was speaking on Monday, Barack Obama will speak on Thursday, and a torch is passing to a new generation of Democrats, let alone Americans.
And we saw that emblemized, as you mentioned, by Michelle Obama's address on Monday. Monday night, where she tried to portray herself and her husband as humble products of the American dream.
In this great country where a girl from the south side of Chicago can go to college and law school, and the son of a single mother from Hawaii can go all the way to the White House, that we committed ourselves. We committed ourselves to building the world as it should be.
Michelle Obama addressing the Democratic National Convention on Monday night, and that was certainly the highlight of the first day of the Democratic National Convention, Ken.
You know, what's funny is, and yet I saw a lot of comments by Democratic partisans who said that the Democrats were not tough enough on Bush and McCain. They were not tough enough on the Republicans. I thought, I mean, from my standpoint, and I was on the floor, standing up, though, I mean, I'm not lying on the floor, but standing up on the floor of the convention, I thought it was a perfect mood to begin the week of you know, party activity. Ted Kennedy was very warm or very gracious. I mean, a lot of tears, you know, nobody expected to see him there. Michelle Obama still addressed the fact that a lot of people don't know who Barack Obama is. And for all the complaints about there was no red meat, well, you certainly had the red meat last night on the stage.
And we can expect some tomorrow night, or tonight rather, when Joe Biden, the new vice presidential nominee, takes the stage, along with Bill Clinton. A little less clear what Bill Clinton's going to have to say.
Right. With Joe Biden, it's clear, I think, as everybody agrees, the first 3 hours of Joe Biden's speech are always the most dynamic. I think everybody enjoys that the most. But, you know, Hillary Clinton made it clear how she feels about Barack Obama. And, again, a tremendous speech last night. There's more question about Bill Clinton because his remarks about Barack Obama have been far more tepid, far more reserved than his wife. And, you know, if anybody seems to be most upset about the result of the Democratic nomination, who the Democratic nominee will be, it seems to be more Bill Clinton. So it will be very interesting to see his reaction, his body language when he speaks.
One of the questions that he sort of tap danced his way around was Barack Obama ready to be president of the United States? Let's see if he addresses that question tonight. There's been some Republican criticism that Hillary Clinton did not address that question directly last night. So let's see if it comes up tonight in the address by former President Clinton to the Democratic National Convention in Denver. So what message are you hearing from the Democrats in Denver? Are you listening? Are you tuning in? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. More with political junkie Ken Rudin when we come back in just a moment. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. Out in Denver, we have Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. He's covering the Democratic Convention there for us this week. Later, we expect the roll call vote that will nominate Barack Obama as the Democratic candidate for president, though there are still some questions as about how exactly that's going to work, all of this leading up to Obama's acceptance speech tomorrow night at Mile High Stadium, which seats some 75,000 people. If you've been watching this week, what message are you hearing from the Democrats in Denver? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can read what other listeners have to say on our blog as well, npr.org/blogofthenation. Of course, we'll take questions from the audience here at the Newseum as well. And Ken, before we get to those questions about what listeners are hearing from the Democrats in Denver, there's some other political news this week, including an interesting primary in the state of Alaska.
Right. Ted Stevens, who's been a senator since 1968, longer than any Republican in the history of the Senate, is under indictment for a corruption scandal. He's always won re-election by overwhelming majorities. But, you know, he's under indictment. There's a cloud over him. But yesterday's primary was interesting. He won pretty handily, over 65, close to 70% in a field of six candidates. But some Democrats think that's the best thing that could have happened to them because Ted Stevens remains very vulnerable. You have a very popular Democratic opponent, Mark Begich, the mayor of Anchorage. So it could be bad news for the Republicans. But I think most people feel that Stevens won by a larger margin than anyone expected.
And there's one congressional seat in the state of Alaska. That one in the Republican side, that primary is a squeaker.
Well, that's very interesting. Don Young, who is Don Young became a congressman in 1973 after Mark Begich's father, Nick Begich, died in a plane crash. I mean, that's just how closely everybody is involved in Alaska. But Don Young is also under an FBI investigation. Talk about giving some favors to campaign donors, and he barely squeaked by. We don't even know, it's not even official yet, but he has like a 100-vote lead or something like that over the lieutenant governor of Alaska, who, by the way, was endorsed by the governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin. So the Republican Party is really split. in Alaska. It's a state that has been in GOP control for a long, long time. But again, as we talked about the new change on the Democratic presidential front, there seems to be a change going on in Alaska as well.
And also in Detroit, one Democratic superdelegate is not in Denver. The mayor of Detroit is still there, and apparently his fate is now going to be decided as mayor at the state capitol.
Right. Governor Jennifer Granholm has the power to remove him as mayor. The city council already passed a non-binding 5-4 vote saying that he should resign. Of course, he will not resign. And Granholm, they're having a September 3rd hearing. It's very possible that she may decide Kilpatrick should be removed. And, of course, there are racial overtones there because Kilpatrick is African-American, and there are a lot of people saying that this is not worthy of being removed from office. It's about lying and an affair and perhaps some city funds being used. But again, in a state like Michigan, which is so crucial to Barack Obama's chances, it's a distraction. I assume the Democrats would not like to have.
Well, anyway, let's get back to what message people are hearing from the convention. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Let's start here at the museum.
This is Adam from Morristown, New Jersey. I was just wondering if you thought that, I guess you could call it a borderline obsession with going green at this year's DNC, from biodegradable balloons to feng shui dishes to no red meat. Would you say this serves as a good indicator of the Democrats' future environmental policies?
Ken?
Well, I think obviously ever since Al Gore, certainly the environment has been a big Democratic issue, but Republicans have taken it on as well. John McCain is also, you know, I mean, he's criticized for some of his environmental votes, but the Republicans are liking that as well. You know, I've been wearing the same underwear in Denver for 4 days just, you know, to conserve water and things like that. But it's obviously a big issue there, but Denver... First of all, Denver and Colorado are big environmental, big green states when it comes to the environment, and that message is clearly getting across and everything that's happening here this week.
And if you look at the political ads, the one thing that both candidates seem to endorse is wind turbines. So that's nothing. Now, let's see if we get some callers on the line, and let's go to Ron. Ron with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hey there. Thanks for taking the call.
Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say that I was really energized by Hillary Clinton last night. And frankly, I mean, I thought that they were taking the gloves off when Obama chose Biden as his running mate. He was my original choice before the primaries got past Iowa. I thought that was going to be happening. And Hillary just proved it last night. I originally voted for her in the primaries in Arizona, and came to regret my decision because of the way her campaign conducted themselves. But if she had kept that tone through the primaries, I think she'd be the nominee now.
Well, it was certainly one of the closest races, the closest race in my memory, Ken. So nevertheless, do you think a lot of Democrats were energized by Hillary Clinton last night?
Oh, it was a tremendous speech. I mean, again, there was a lot of anticipation, a lot of angst heading into it. But, you know, people said had she given that kind of speech before, she'd be the nominee. Had Michigan and Florida counted when it should have counted, she would have been the nominee. I saw a release today from Michael Dukakis, who apologized for losing to George Bush Sr. in 1988. I'm not making this up. He said it's his fault that we have George W. Bush today because he lost to Bush Sr. in 88. So, you know, I guess if Burr hadn't shot Hamilton, things would have been different today. A lot of what-ifs involved here, but the point is that Hillary gave a great, great speech. About Joe Biden, though, you know, a lot of Democrats are excited about the prospect of Joe Biden being the attack dog he is, and of course that's not what Obama likes to do, and everybody's anticipating the vice presidential debate. But remember, we go back to 1988, we always think of Lloyd Benson and Dan Quayle and how everybody says that Lloyd Benson wiped the floor with Dan Quayle, and yet Bush Quayle won 40 out of 50 states that year. So we talk about the vice presidency, and we spend a lot of time talking about it this week, but ultimately, and I've said this over and over again, voters vote for the top of the ticket, and I think that's what it'll come down to.
Ron, thanks very much for the phone call.
All right.
And you mentioned, Ken, red meat. Well, certainly Senator McCain handed the Obama campaign a gift late last week when Senator McCain could not remember, asked how many houses that he owns in the Obama campaign, replied with an attack ad very quickly.
Maybe you're struggling just to pay the mortgage on your home. But recently, John McCain said the fundamentals of our economy are strong. Then again that same day, when asked how many houses he owns, McCain lost track. He couldn't remember. Well, it's seven. Seven houses. And here's one house America can't afford to let John McCain move into.
A picture of the White House there, and there's some dispute. It might be seven houses, might be eight. In any case, we've also seen attack ads by outside groups. There's an ad that's running in certain television markets in Michigan by the same people who brought you the Swift Boat ads 4 years ago. Ken?
Oh, that means me. I was wondering whether you would hear a tape of that.
Well, no, we played a clip of it earlier.
These ads are very effective, and I think on the number of homes, I mean, John McCain will say, look, you know, my wife's finances and mine are separate, and I don't know what you count and which ones, what condominiums you count and what you don't count. But a lot of people here on the floor at Denver are wearing these buttons saying, ask me how many homes I own. So obviously it was one of those telling remarks that the Democrats will love to portray John McCain as being out of touch. But again, we're going to see next week when the Republicans meet in St. Paul that, you know, if John McCain is out of touch, then Barack Obama is an elitist, and you'll see those commercials as well. And, you know, a lot of people who follow politics say, well, this should be, you know, voters should be smarter than this, should not pay attention to this kind of, you know, scurrilous stuff. But we've seen it also works, and I think that's why they do it.
Let's get another question from here at the museum.
Hi, I'm Susan from Albany, New York. And I want to preface my question saying I never was a Clinton supporter. But Barack Obama has identified Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals, as one of his favorites. And I wondered if you saw any influence of the book on his choices, or you could make any predictions based on the book.
Ken?
Wow. Well, you know, I've long tried to stay out of the prediction business. I mean, I thought Jack Reed would be the vice president on the Democratic side. I was convinced Barack Obama was going to win the New Hampshire primary. So I'm pretty wrong on mostly everything. And that's why I'm on this show. But but you know something? I mean, obviously, Barack Obama had a lot of things. Barack Obama had a resume gap to fill, and that was on foreign policy experience. You know, whatever Joe Biden does or does not bring to the ticket, Biden has been in the Senate Foreign Relations. He's been in the Senate since 1973. He has tremendous foreign policy experience, a strong debater, as I said earlier, a good attack dog. And I sense that that there's a comfort level. And a lot of people are talking about, you know, John McCain perhaps picking Mitt Romney. They don't seem to have that comfort level. Romney and McCain went after each other during the primaries. If McCain is going to use Hillary Clinton's comments about Obama in his commercials, you know the Democrats will have a field day repeating, regurgitating what McCain and Romney said about each other. So obviously there is a comfort level when you pick a team, and so far it seems like Obama is very comfortable with the person he's chosen as VP.
And Ken, we have Doris Kearns Goodwin with us right here. No, we don't. It's the old Woody Allen joke. That book will be committed to memory by next week. So we'll get an answer for it.
Right.
Let's see if we can get here's an email. This is from Richard in Cleveland. Hillary threw her support to Obama. What is Obama doing to get Hillary supporters appeased? I'm looking forward for Obama to make his case for himself on Thursday night.
Well, I mean, look, if the roles were reversed and Hillary Clinton were the nominee, and if we were spending all this time talking about what Barack Obama wants and what Barack Obama's people want, I think there'd be an outrage from the Hillary Clinton people saying, look, I'm the nominee, not him. Let's focus on me. So I think Obama has been very magnanimous about this, which has been a distraction for him. He has not shown any irritation. He has not criticized. But the Clinton people do feel that Obama has not done enough to raise money for Clinton, Hillary Clinton. You know, it's interesting. Right after Hillary Clinton gave that great speech last night, her campaign sent out another fundraising email saying, if you know, there's a great speech, but please give money to us. When everybody was holding up the Hillary Clinton signs last night, on the bottom, it did not say BarackObama.org. It said HillaryClinton.org. So it was very interesting that there still seems to be two different camps there. But again, obviously, I suspect, just as Hillary Clinton did last night, Barack Obama's speech would not only talk about what he intends to do as president, what American people need to hear, but a very gracious, I suspect, reach out to Hillary Clinton. He's already said that he thought her speech last night was outstanding.
Well, it was certainly a great speech. Anyway, we're talking with our political junkie, Ken Rudin. If you'd like to read his political column, if there's some reason you think that might be helpful, you can find the political junkie column at npr.org. He's with us every Wednesday here at the Newseum. Today he's in Denver. Next week he'll join us from St. Paul in Minnesota, where the Republicans hold their convention contest. We're expecting Senator McCain to announce his vice presidential pick on Friday of this week to try to take whatever steam may have built up by the Democrats away as quickly as possible and get the Republicans back on the front burner. And, of course, you'll find coverage of that right here at NPR and on NPR.org. You can listen to coverage of the convention at NPR.org and tonight at many of these NPR radio stations. I'll get that straight. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Kat on the line. Kat calling us from Grand Junction in Colorado.
Hello.
Hi.
What I'm taking away from watching the whole thing this week is the kind of hope that we've all been needing for so long. And also, I think it was Deval Patrick who called for us to let go of our cynicism. I have been fighting this for so long. So many people have become so cynical about our political process and the direction our country has gone in the past failed 8 years. What I'm hearing from Deval Patrick and the other speakers who were so inspirational, the governor of Montana and Hillary Clinton herself, is that we need to let go of the cynicism and really, really put our hope into backing Barack Obama.
So,
and
Kat,
that's certainly something I intend on doing.
So, Kat, you're looking for inspiration, hope, rather than red meat.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks very much.
We haven't had any of that for so long. We know the red meat will come along.
Thanks.
We know that. It can't help but come along. But we need that. We have to turn our minds and our hearts to the positive. And the more we do that, the more we have power to turn our country around.
Thanks very much for the call, Kat. And that replicates an argument that's been ongoing within the Obama campaign, Ken.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, it was a brutal primary campaign, but Barack Obama can be very inspirational. I think one of the reasons he will be the nominee officially tomorrow, officially tonight, actually, is because he is inspirational and he sells hope. Hillary Clinton in the past has said you need more than rhetoric. John McCain, of course, has tried to pick up on that theme. But, you know, there's a lot of hope in 1988 for the Democrats in Atlanta. Michael Dukakis came out of that convention with a 17-point lead. So it'll be very interesting to see, even if the party sounds united coming out of Denver, even if the polls show a bump, you know, the Republicans are coming back next week. It'll be very interesting to see, when all is said and done, after the two campaigns, after the two conventions are over, what the numbers will look like. And then you have a very compact general election campaign.
Let's see if we can get another question from here in the Newseum.
Hi, my name is Zach from Tempe, Arizona. I was just wanting to know why the elitist question has been such a big deal during the primaries and this whole election on both sides. Isn't the whole point of the primaries and the election to find the best, most qualified candidate? And wouldn't we want a member of the elite as a president, or is it just a question of status or attitude?
Well, elite is one of those loaded, you know, pejoratives. I mean, you don't want somebody to be an elitist, but theoretically, I mean, Franklin D. Roosevelt was an elitist, John F. Kennedy was an elitist, and yet they still spoke for the common man and common language. So I think it's just something they like to throw out at people. And then when you talk about Barack Obama's education, I mean, the thought of somebody, you know, being born in Hawaii to a white and black parents coming out as an elitist is pretty remarkable. But you know something? I think the McCain people know that they have a great orator in Barack Obama, and I don't think they know how to deal with it. And so they decided that elitist would be the kind of word that you want to throw out there.
And it certainly was the kind of charge that worked against John Kerry, too.
That's true. I mean, but of course, you know, anybody who's windsurfing on vacation is something that exactly what fell into the hands just of the Bush campaign. You know, George W. Bush was sold as somebody you'd like to go out and have a beer with, while John Kerry also was windsurfing. Let me just tell you also, before we run out of time, that you should know that the delegates right now are all in their hotel rooms. They are now coalescing. They're deciding who's voting for whom. And so when the roll call begins later this afternoon on the floor, you know, somebody from, you know, the state of Colorado will come out and say Colorado cast its 12 delegates for Hillary Clinton and 11 delegates for Barack Obama, whatever. So right now, all the delegates are meeting in their rooms going over those numbers right now. We suspect that there will be an initial roll call of a tally of states at the convention. And then, the speculation is that Hillary Clinton will come out and call it to an stop the roll call vote and say Barack Obama's nomination should be made by acclamation.
Ken Rudin, thanks very much. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Neil.
Political junkie Ken Rudin with us from Denver. Again, he'll be with us from St. Paul next week. Up next, we continue our series of conversations on This American Moment. Christopher Hitchens will join us. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, as we await the speech by Senator Obama tomorrow in Denver and Republicans paired to gather in St. Paul, we continue This American Moment. All this week and next, we're taking a step back to put this election and this campaign season in context. We're asking a different guest every day to tell us what he or she thinks is at stake, what this election means to him or her. And today we talk with a relatively new American. Christopher Hitchens became a United States citizen in April of last year. That, of course, after his famous political conversion from the left, with iconoclastic positions now at several spots along the political spectrum. We'd especially like to hear from conservative voters today. What's the significance of this American moment? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Christopher Hitchens is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and the author of many books, including God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. He joins us today from a studio at Stanford University. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Very nice of you to invite me.
And you're a longtime observer of the American political scene. This, though, is going to be the first time you're going to be able to vote for president, and I wonder what this moment means to you.
Yes, that's right. I've actually already voted in the primaries in Washington. Though we're, as you know, we're disenfranchised. We have taxation without representation in point of congressional representation. And I'm a single-issue voter, to get straight to the point. I'm really only interested in the candidate who's toughest and least apologetic when it comes to the confrontation with Islamic jihadism.
That's the central issue for you?
Yes.
Why?
Well, because I think it's the principal threat, and because I think that it tests our readiness to say that we think our civilization is worth fighting for and is better than those who attack it. And I look, not just with politicians, but full-time with commentators, intellectuals, friends, for any note of apology, any sort of weakness or indecision on that point, which I've come to consider to be morally and ideologically central.
We've had a lot of discussion after the brief war between Russia and Georgia that this reminds us that there's an awful lot of politics going on elsewhere in the world, not just the emergence of a more nationalist Russia, the challenge of China, which we saw its economic wealth put to such great benefit to its cause in its presentation of the Olympic Games. An awful lot going on, and a lot of people saying, wait a minute, this threat from Al-Qaeda and Islamic movements, it's just part of a larger mosaic. We have to put it in context.
Well, I wouldn't want to differ very strongly with that, and I've been writing a lot about the emergence under Vladimir Putin of a new form of Russian imperialism, actually a Russian Orthodox imperialism. It's very little remarked that the cement, the political, ideological cement of the Russian regime now, communism having collapsed and imploded, is increasingly a confessional one. When Mr. Medvedev was sworn in, for example, he had to kiss some holy icon in the presence of an archbishop. The Russian Orthodox Church has demanded and got tremendous privileges for itself in exchange for becoming a prop and mouthpiece of the regime. And so there's a real danger now of a Russian religious come nationalist chauvinist imperialism. And it's not just in Georgia, but in the Ukraine, where I'm convinced the Russians were behind the poisoning of the freely elected president there, in the attempt to sabotage the economy of Estonia, in the siding with Slobodan Milosevic and his heirs in the Balkans, and in countless other places too. It's very, very serious business.
But
you will notice that Russia and China, invariably at the United Nations, move to block American action to repress or hem in or punish other kinds of outlaw. Who stands behind Mugabe at the United Nations? Russia and China do. Who tried successfully to prevent the United Nations from speaking with one voice on its most signal violation of its resolutions? Iraq, Russia and China again. North Korea the same, Burma the same.
Given those examples, though, you still regard September the 11th as the critical moment, the pivotal moment?
Yes, I think I'd have to say I do. Because it meant suddenly that it was as dangerous, if you like, to be in America as it was to be overseas. So that the false distinction that's made by the anti-war movement between being over there and over here was exposed for all to see as an illusion, although a number of people, large number of people, still share in it. In other words, when I've been in Iraq or Afghanistan, I've probably been safer because I can carry a weapon if I have to, or I can go with people who do, than my wife and daughter are living in Washington.
Where they now can carry weapons, too, thanks to the Supreme Court.
Well, how right you are, though my wife on principle wouldn't do that. It has been decided, I think, correctly that the ban that Washington had was unconstitutional.
Before the attacks of September the 11th, you were widely regarded as a leftist. Do you now regard yourself as a conservative, and does that equate to Republican?
No, I don't regard myself as any kind of conservative, except conceivably neo, and that word, of course, is a ridiculous appellation because it's used to describe a group that was ready to make war on the status quo, which is not a conservative position. But I don't like that appellation either. I consider myself a radical. My friends in Iraq, for example, in particular the leadership of autonomous Kurdistan, all have socialist and often communist backgrounds. It's also true of quite a lot of those who are resisting the Taliban in Afghanistan, and was true of many of the Bosnian fighters against Slobodan Milosevic. It was on these points of foreign policy where I decided that America was not interventionist enough, which, of course, did mean a bit of a breach with old comrades on the left, that I found that the international left in the countries concerned took the same position as I did. So it's, in my view, the left that's become reactionary and isolationist and parochial.
We're talking with Christopher Hitchens about This American Moment, his most recent book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And given that title of that book, are you comfortable with either of the major political parties in this country?
No, one of the most repellent spectacles at election times is the pretense of piety on the part of people running for office. I personally think these people are not pushing as they think they are at an open door. All the recent opinion poll findings show that the largest group of, the fastest growing group of opinion in America is made up of those who have no religious affiliation. That's not to say these people are atheists, but they are not affiliated. They don't go to any church. Fast and growing and large. In my travels around the country debating in churches and in synagogues on the religious question, I've also found there's a great deal of doubt and skepticism among people who identify as believers as well. And third, I think there's a very great consensus, including among people who are devout and are genuinely religious, that religion should not be exploited by politicians. So there's nothing more vulgar than the sound of someone saying, God bless America, and so on, who doesn't really believe it, but who thinks it'll make him look good to other people. I think it's the most nauseating spectacle.
Let's see if we get some listeners in on the conversation. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's get Bill on. Bill's calling us from Chicago, Illinois.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I just wanted to say I characterize myself as conservative because that's a convenient label. Unfortunately, there isn't a label for what I am because I see this election as being a challenge between individuals who are willing to stand up and say, this is what I believe, and this new dangerous, in my opinion, collectivist view that, well, we need to rule by committee, we need to make everybody happy. I really question sometimes whether political candidates have the spine to take a stand and take an unpopular position that may be the right position, because it seems like there's this real challenge now of are we going to do what's popular or do what's right? And I'll take my comments off.
Well, Bill, quickly, I just wondered how you saw that differentiation playing out in this campaign. Which side is which? I think Bill has already left us.
I'm sure know what he's going through. I mean, the thing that if we're going to talk about our pet peeves about electoral demagogy. Mine is, and I find it amusing too, and we've had a lot of it from Denver this week, and you can bet we're in for a lot more. Here's how you can prove this is the greatest country in the world, okay? Because everyone in it is having everyone in the United States is having a really hard time. It's the greatest country in the world because people are unemployed, because people are hurting, because they're struggling, because they're sick and they can't meet their doctor's bills and so on. It's in the same speech all the time. And no one ever seems to notice.
Let's get a question from here in the museum.
Hi, I'm
or
Matthew.
Spiro Agnew apparently once said, this is the greatest country in the nation. Or was it the greatest nation in the country? I can't remember.
Probably both. Sir, I'm sorry.
Hi, I'm Matthew from Atlanta. It seems that with so many issues causing concern for American voters this year, it's kind of difficult to pinpoint a single defining a point. But for me, it seems that as Russia has just openly stated that it has no fear of another Cold War, we have a choice ahead of us, especially among conservatives, and you had encouraged conservative voters to comment. And the question, it seems to me, is do we bargain with Russia? Do we play ball with Russia in order to obtain their cooperation with the uranium problem and the North Korean problem? Or, on the other hand, do we draw a thick red line around the Eastern Bloc ex-Soviet states that we have, sort of pledged our support and our protection of?
Chris Hitchens, what do you think?
Well, there was a big argument about this about a decade ago under the Clinton administration about NATO expansion. And the underlying principle difference was this. Some said if you expand NATO, you will provoke the Russians. They'll think they're being encircled. And the other opposite case was they are going to try and regain their temporarily lost influence in Eastern and Balkan Europe in any case. So the quicker we can get as many members as we can under the protective umbrella in this period of Russian, what shall we call it, eclipse, the better. I think the second view was the more intelligent one. The Russians are going to be expansionist whether we provoke them to it or not. For example, the Russians keep saying that we're trying to encircle them. In what sense does the independence of Kosovo, a landlocked province, former Yugoslavia, with no common border with Russia, threaten Russia with encirclement? In what sense does the independence of the Baltic states, which the Soviets gained as territory in a deal with Hitler, a direct bargain between Stalin and Hitler, it constitute an encirclement? This is insulting. In what sense does the independence of Georgia constitute an encirclement? What we are facing, and we may as well give it its right name, is what I called it earlier, a chauvinistic, theocratic, in part, xenophobic Russian imperialism.
We're talking with Christopher Hitchens on This American Moment. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So given what you've described as the centrality, the single issue, you said, as to who will be tougher and less apologetic about Islamic extremism, and what you've been talking about Russia, what do you see as it being at stake in this election?
Well, precisely that. There are those. I think I'll try and condense my thought into one. There are those who recognize that we are in a fight with other superpowers, or potential superpowers, as well as with radical jihadist Islam. And there are those who don't recognize it. And then there are those of whom I think Senator Obama is one, who recognize it, all right, when it's pointed out to them. Don't disagree, but you can tell, wish it wasn't true.
Wish it wasn't true.
Wish it wasn't true. By the way, this is not a left-right distinction, because I would say that probably the most articulate spokesman for the anti-war movement in this country is Pat Buchanan, who is in no sense a leftist. And it's also true, of course, that another group of the right wing around what might be called the Kissinger Associates group, sometimes known as the realists, has also been very opposed, say, to the intervention in Iraq. So it isn't a simple ideological division.
I wonder, as you look at this election and now your participation in it, does that change your views as to what it means to be an American at all?
No. I mean, one of the reasons I decided to apply for American citizenship after something like a quarter of a century of living here on a British European Union passport and a green card was my identification with the United States in the post-September 11th period, and my resentment, really, at the complacency and hypocrisy of what was sometimes characterized in our press as the European worldview of these matters, one that either put America on all fours with its enemies, making it morally equivalent, or even worse, said it had brought these revenges upon itself.
And in the current context, we see a Western Europe, which is relies on the Russians for, what, half their natural gas and a quarter of their petroleum, being considerably less aggressive than the United States.
Yes, with the exception, I'm happy to say, of the British Labour government, which has been pretty forthright about Georgia and other matters, as has the leader of the opposition in Britain, David Cameron. But yes, you're right. The European instinct is, as it always has been, to temporize on these questions.
And China, finally, the enormous economic challenge. China has been much more cautious in terms of its foreign policy.
Well, a little more, yes. But, I mean, just take one very salient case, that of Darfur. If people want to shout blood for oil, this is the time they should be doing it. China takes almost all of Sudan's oil and in return supplies it with the sinews of genocide, the weaponry with which to complete what's nearly already done, the mass murder of the people of Darfur, and provides them also with diplomatic cover. It's also the case that China is the great defender of the North Korean regime, an incurable totalitarian aggressor, and the Burmese military dictatorship, and Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. This isn't a militarized aggression by China, but it's the export of violence and tyranny by other means. And it bears watching.
Christopher Hitchens, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate
it. Bears watching by all those who say we should rely on the UN, by the way, mm-hmm. where between them, Russia and China can always outvote us.
Christopher Hitchens is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. His most recent book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. He joins today from a studio on the campus at Stanford University. Tomorrow, we continue This American Moment with former President Jimmy Carter. You stay tuned to NPR for more live coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Denver on many public radio stations and at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.